Coming up on Fronteras, as Congress considers adding 700 miles of new fencing along the U.S.-Mexico border, a look at how environmental concerns stack up against border security.
I just think we could have done better biologically and ecologically than what we did with this approach.
Also on Fronteras, this weekend marks the 20th anniversary of the outdoor jail that has become a symbol of the law enforcement style of Maricopa County's Sheriff Joe Arpaio. The facility, Tent City, has survived 2 decades in spite of fierce opposition.
This is a failed experiment. It's too dangerous, too inhumane. It violates fundamental constitutional principles.
We take a look at the legacy of that jail, but first, the news. This is Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras was created via an unprecedented multimedia collaboration among 7 public radio stations. It's funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting as part of its Local Journalism Center initiative. I'm Crystal Chavez. Congress is considering building hundreds of miles of new fencing along the U.S.-Mexico border as part of immigration reform. From our Fronteras desk, Jill Replegal reminds us of the last big fence-building push and the fight that centered on the fence's potential effects on San Diego's fragile border ecosystems.
It's a clear, breezy morning on the scrubby hills overlooking the Tijuana River Valley. Border Patrol jeeps cruise along the dirt roads that switch back up and down the hills along the border fence. One drags a contraption made of tires that combs the road so agents can later detect fresh footprints. I'm here with Mike McCoy, a 71-year-old veterinarian and longtime San Diego resident. McCoy has spent more than half his life working to protect the estuary formed where the Tijuana River's fresh water meets the salty Pacific Ocean.
We're going down toward Smuggler's Gulch. This is probably the most difficult cut for them and the most problematic cut for us.
By us, he means the environmentalists and local land managers who vigorously fought against the massive earth-moving project that in 2009 filled in the deep gulch and built a road across it in the name of border security.
Before, it was going down these switchbacks, and that took a long time. This way, they just fly right through here.
By they, McCoy means Border Patrol agents scouting the area for illegal smuggling. Starting in the 1990s, this place became ground zero in the battle over how to secure the border against illegal immigration and drug trafficking. By then, hundreds of illegal crossers swarmed down the hills nightly from Tijuana. Then 9/11 happened, and concerns mounted about terrorists coming in through porous borders. As a result, Congress ordered a fence built across 700 miles of the southern border, in addition to San Diego's fortified triple fence that was already planned. Opponents of the fence here had slowed construction down for years through public outcry and lawsuits. Frustrated, Congress passed legislation giving the Department of Homeland Security the right to waive all legal requirements in order to expedite construction.
And that removed a major tool of environmentalists and others opposed to the construction.
Paul Ganster directs the Institute for Regional Studies of the Californias at San Diego State University.
It really removed many of the requirements for an open process, for public hearings, things that citizens and communities and environmentalists had fought for. Really from the 70s.
Since then, Homeland Security has waived close to 40 federal laws and countless state laws to build new sections of fence all across the U.S.-Mexico border, some of it across federally protected areas and habitat for endangered and threatened species. Here's Mike McCoy.
Deer and jaguar and snoring pronghorn.
McCoy says fences can block genetic exchange among these big animals, weakening the species. Now there's talk in Congress of adding 700 new miles of fence along the southern border and giving Homeland Security even more power to waive laws to build it and other border infrastructure. Border Patrol refused to grant an interview for this story, but I did talk to Sean Moran. He's vice president of the Border Patrol Union. Moran says generally fencing is just a speed bump.
The fence really hasn't cut down on human smuggling, because if you build a 20-foot fence, the smuggling organizations. They just build a 21-foot ladder and they get the people over it.
But he says the contentious San Diego fence was needed. Illegal traffic here has slowed to a trickle. It's moved to Arizona and Texas. And Moran says adding hundreds of miles to the U.S.-Mexico border fence would probably help agents by funneling illegal traffic into areas they can control.
It's not the answer to border security, but it is a primary tool that the Border Patrol has to slow down things.
Walking along San Diego's border fence, Mike McCoy admits the impact hasn't been all bad. Illegal crossers used to tromp through sensitive areas here, and he does understand the need for a secure border.
I just think we could have done better biologically and ecologically than what we did with this approach.
What really rankles McCoy is the supreme trump card held by one federal agency, the Department of Homeland Security.
Kind of my way or the highway type thing. And that's not the way America worked to me. We all had a say in what went forward.
As this year's debate over immigration and border security gets louder, environmental concerns are barely a whisper. In San Diego, I'm Jill Replogle.
A new study by the World Health Organization finds that one in three women is assaulted in her lifetime. For Native American women, that number is almost twice as high, at 61%. The Hopi Nation in northern Arizona is in the middle of what advocates call a domestic violence epidemic. But after years of secrecy, victims are starting to come forward. From the Changing America desk, Ann Hoffman brings us this story from Kings Canyon, Arizona.
One domestic violence survivor, a mother whose name I won't use to protect her safety, suffered for years before she reported her husband to local authorities. He slapped her once before they were married. Then he started calling her names. And as his drinking got worse, so did his outbursts.
While I was pregnant, he poked me real hard in my stomach. I had given myself to him, so it took me a while to stop.
She finally reported him to police after he threw a DVD player at her. She hid and made sure her kids were safe. They waited half an hour before reservation police arrived.
By then, he had already kind of calmed down.
Her experience is typical of a domestic violence case on the reservation. It can take tribal police up to an hour to respond to a call because they're low on staff and homes are far apart. Even when they arrive on the scene, there's no shelter to take victims to on the tribe's land. The closest one is an hour and a half away, and it's usually full. It's easy to understand why victims weren't reporting. The risk of revenge from an abuser is high, and while the reservation is spread out geographically, it's extremely close-knit socially. Information travels quickly. And even when an abuser is in jail, his family can make life difficult for the victim.
I guess, in a way, kind of harassed by the family. They treated me real bad, and then when the kids came around, they didn't even acknowledge them.
Attorney Dorma Sania is Hopi and works with tribes across the western United States as a domestic violence specialist. She says in recent years, things have started to change.
Women are getting together and they're talking about it and they're trying to strategize and figure out, you know, what some of the solutions could be.
Hopi victims started coming forward for a number of reasons, including stronger sentencing and a series of aggressive chief prosecutors. But it was a homegrown, Hopi-run nonprofit called the Hopi Tewa Women's Coalition to End Abuse that brought domestic violence into the spotlight. The group started holding events about sexual assault and partner abuse in 2011. Roxanne Josefa works for the organization, and she says 2 days after their first conference, the calls came pouring in.
People were calling and saying, I needed help, or I was abused, I was sexually assaulted, and so we knew then that, you know, there was people out there who were just too afraid to come out.
This year, 40 people have come forward and filed domestic violence cases on the reservation. Jill Engel is the chief prosecutor for the Hopi tribe.
I've seen many photos of the injuries they've sustained at the hands of people they love, including being slashed with machetes, stabbed.
The tribe also changed its legal code last year to give perpetrators more jail time. Instead of spending 1 year in jail on an assault charge, convicted abusers could face up to 2 years per count. That's still not nearly as many years as someone would face in a non-tribal court, where sentences range from 2 to 20 years. But Engel says it's made a difference.
It's improved significantly the number of women, I think, that are reporting and actually following through with prosecution.
The Hopi mother I interviewed was able to leave her husband after police came to her house during an especially bad incident. But ultimately, she found the strength to get out when she saw him hurt their little girl. Traditionally, the Hopi are matrilineal, so girls carry on the family name.
She's important because she's going to be carrying on our clan, so I have to take care of her more than the boy. It sounds bad, I know, but...
Her daughter used to be scared of men and got angry when anyone got near her mom. But since her parents' divorce and her dad's conviction, her mom says she's been a lot calmer. I'm Ann Hoffman in Flagstaff.
There's still more Fronteras coming up. This weekend marks the 20th anniversary of the outdoor jail Tent City, a symbol of Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio's law enforcement style.
This is a failed experiment. It's too dangerous, too inhumane. It violates fundamental constitutional principles.
The legacy of that jail. Stay tuned. This is Fronteras. I'm Crystal Chavez. This weekend marks the 20th anniversary of an unorthodox outdoor jail in Phoenix known as Tent City. The facility was originally set up as a stopgap solution to jail overcrowding, but has since become a symbol of Sheriff Joe Arpaio's law enforcement regime. And the publicity the jail generates may be one of Arpaio's biggest legacies. From the Fronteras desk in Phoenix, Jude Joffe Block reports.
In the past 20 years, Tent City has become so famous and such a spectacle that the jail gets requests from the public for tours several times a week. Today's tour is being led by a jail sergeant, James Lewis. On our way outdoors to see the tents, Lewis shows us a big cabinet.
This is some of the contraband we've collected over the years.
The doors swing open to reveal ropes made out of blankets, a toothbrush with a razor blade in it, and multiple shanks.
Oh my gosh.
There are three women on today's tour, all in their late 20s. None of them would speak on the record, but they're here because they saw a TV special on Tent City and wanted to see it up close. Lewis leads us outside.
On this side, we have the males. There's a fence in the middle where there's the females.
Setting up tents in the desert to deal with jail overcrowding was the brainchild of Maricopa County's six-term sheriff, Joe Arpaio. There's capacity for more than 2,000 inmates, all of them sentenced to 1 year or less. They're given pink underwear and work in old-fashioned chain gangs. The temperatures on the bunks can get up to the 130s in the summer.
We can also go out into the middle of the yard if you guys want. You just can't talk to any inmates and take any pictures of any inmates, and it's at your own risk. So it's up to you guys how far you want to go.
After some hesitation, the tour ventures in the yard. The inmates mill around the tents, looking hot and bored. Many are shirtless because of the heat. This kind of get-tough-on-crime approach on display here at Tent City generally plays well with the public. The women on the tour were impressed. One said she supported the jail because she thought anyone who spent a year at a place this miserable wouldn't be likely to reoffend. In fact, that rationale was behind Sheriff Arpaio's decision to put up the tents in his first year of office.
My theory was they should not live better in the jails, and I want to send a message, put them in tents, and they're all convicted. They're not innocent. I only put convicted people as a deterrence effect.
In the late 90s, Arpaio hired two Arizona State University criminologists to find out the impact of his brand of punitive policies. One of the researchers was John Hepburn.
And we tried to look at those in terms of whether or not they had made any difference in the likelihood that people who were sent to jail would return to jail anytime in the near future.
The results surprised Hepburn. What he found was that Arpaio's policies made no difference in whether or not an inmate returned to jail. Meanwhile, Hepburn says, national trends in corrections have moved away from tough punishment regimes. These days, some corrections consultants point to Tent City as an example of what not to do.
This is a failed experiment.
Attorney Michael Manning has sued the sheriff's office several times for millions of dollars on behalf of the families of inmates who've died in the county's various jails. He says Tent City allows too many inmates, some of them with violent histories, to be in close quarters with too few guards to supervise.
It's too dangerous, too inhumane. It violates fundamental constitutional principles.
In Manning's litigation against the county, he discovered that some expert consultants the sheriff hired several years ago recommended shutting down Tent City. Arpaio ignored the idea then and says he has no plans to get rid of the tents now.
And as long as I'm the sheriff, they're going to be there. They're not going anywhere. So if I survive 20 and it's a program that survived, why should I change it?
And why would he? Tent City has been a PR success that's helped Arpaio gain international fame and win re-election over and over again. In Phoenix, I'm Jude Jaffe Block.
The largest wildfire prevention effort of its kind has stalled out, and many of the collaborators are frustrated with the company that won the contract a year ago. Questions have come up surrounding its competence to handle a project of this scale. Environmentalists are calling for an investigation. From Flagstaff, Laurel Morales reports.
The Four Forest Restoration Initiative is the result of dozens of collaborators, government officials, conservationists, scientists, all agreeing that the dry, overgrown forests of the western United States need to be thinned. But that costs money. So 4FRY, as it's called, asked the timber industry to get involved. U.S. Forest Service's Henry Provincio says in 3 years, the 4FRY partners have actually accomplished a lot, including the environmental assessment, identifying the acres to be thinned, and actually agreeing on a plan.
We're laying the foundation. You got to walk before you run, if you will. It's easy to be reactive when we see large fires throughout the West, or especially when they're in your backyard.
As 4FRY's team leader, Provencio has fielded lots of calls from impatient stakeholders and admits he's not a patient person either.
Yeah, acres have been treated. Are they at the scale that we would all like to see? No, absolutely not. You know, they're not at the scale the Forest Service would like to see, the stakeholders, and I would say the contractor.
Under its contract with the Forest Service, Pioneer Forest Products must thin 300,000 acres over the next decade and turn the small diameter trees into wood for furniture. So far, the company has thinned a small fraction of the forest, 500 acres. And Pioneer's Marlon Johnson says it still hasn't secured financing for more thinning in a mill.
The avenues of funding we thought were open to us when we turned in our bid, and when we talked to the Forest Service about it, closed for various reasons.
Johnson says they did find another company that was willing to buy out its contract. And these missteps have led to a call for an investigation by the Center for Biological Diversity. Co-founder Todd Schalke was one of 4FRY's original collaborators.
Did the Forest Service actually do adequate due diligence in evaluating both Pioneer's financial capability, which apparently they have none, or their business plan, which really doesn't pass the laugh test if you talk to industry professionals?
The Forest Service says the agency did do an extensive evaluation of Pioneer's proposal. But what's even more frustrating to a number of people is there's another company ready and waiting to take on the initiative. Arizona Forest Restoration Partners' Don Walters says the company's owner has bought 250 acres to build a mill in Winslow to show they're sincere.
We have been patiently waiting for Pioneer Products to either perform or relinquish their contract.
Walters says he's disappointed to hear Pioneer wants to relinquish the 4FRY contract to a foreign company. The Forest Service could not comment on the potential new contractor. But Arizona's congressional delegation has had a lot to say on the issue. Senators McCain and Flake introduced legislation that gives federal agencies more incentive to contract with the timber industry. Arizona Congresswoman Ann Kirkpatrick supports policies that would make projects like 4FRY more streamlined.
We're still talking with folks on the ground and at the federal level and impressing upon them how critical it is that the 4FRY contractor be able to obtain the funding necessary to move this project forward so we can protect our community from these devastating wildfires.
Kirkpatrick says a lot of people are watching to see how successful 4FRY is, as it was originally seen as a model for future large-scale forest restoration partnerships around the country. I'm Laurel Morales in Flagstaff.
The chilies in your favorite hot sauce may give you more of a kick than you bargained for. A research team at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas has found elevated levels of lead in several hot sauces imported from Mexico. Lead exposure can be dangerous, especially for children and women who are pregnant. Kate Sheehy from the Fronteras Desk reports.
Jennifer Berger and her research partner at UNLV found that 4 out of 25 bottles of hot sauce tested had lead contaminants. She says a 2006 recall of Mexican-style candies made the researchers question hot sauce as well.
And they have very common ingredients, so the chilies and the salt, which is where we suspect that some of the lead contamination comes from.
Lead exposure can slow the mental development of a child and cause learning disabilities. Berger wants the Food and Drug Administration to apply the same standards to hot sauce that they currently use for candy.
We realize that hot sauce is probably not as highly consumed by children, but that would be a safeguard.
The FDA declined to go on tape for this story, but has said they will review the study and consider future actions. Meanwhile, at some Las Vegas groceries, hot sauce sales are as strong as ever. Tina Angel shops at Mariana's Latin Market on Sahara Boulevard. She says she heard on the news about the lead in Mexican hot sauces and says she still has some in her fridge. But now she says she'll make her own hot sauce for the family. In Las Vegas, I'm Kate Sheehy.
You've been listening to Fronteras, a Corporation for Public Broadcasting funded journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras is a collaboration of public radio stations KJZZ Phoenix, KPBS San Diego, KNAU Flagstaff, KNPR Las Vegas, KRWG Las Cruces, KUAZ Tucson, and KSTX San Antonio. We're online at fronterasdesk.org. We're on Facebook, and we invite you to join the conversations there. For headlines and updates, follow us on Twitter. Our handle is at fronterasdesk. You may subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Our theme music was composed by Charanga Cakewalk. I'm Texas Public Radio's Crystal Chavez. Thanks for listening.